He is encountering serious difficulty in finding work mainly, I think, because he is highly qualified yet has none of the usual diplomas or certificates here in England. If there is anything you can do or suggest for him, I would count it as a personal favor. You will, I feel sure, find him extremely interesting. Best regards, John. As Charles read the letter, Dr. Kuhn watched him. He did not as a rule use his psychic abilities overtly. It was too hard, and often unpleasant, for him to know what a person was actually thinking. He had no wish to intrude on the lives of others. In this case, however, it was important to approach Charles in a manner to which he would react favorably. Much rested on the outcome of the meeting. He noted that the man before him was physically unprepossessing. He gave the impression of middle age, although one realized he was not yet 40. Clearly, he paid no attention to his appearance, and was completely without vanity. Balding and overweight, he wore a tweed suit which had seen better days, and now looked baggy and out of date. His physical appearance, however, was of no great interest to Dr. Kuhn. It was merely an indication to the workings of his mind, and that was far from uninteresting. From the aura visible around him, Dr. Kuhn was able to deduce that he enjoyed his position, that he felt he had earned it through hard work. The predominant vibration, or color, his aura emanated was the green of learning. He noted a higher than normal intellect and the wide scope of his interests. It was clear that he was a man alone, someone who did not necessarily fit in with his peers because in most respects he was superior to them. This was all to the good. Neither did he suffer the slightest degree of self-consciousness. Charles crossed to his desk and laid the letter on the blotting pad. He removed his spectacles and helped himself to a peppermint from a Tavener's tin standing opened on the desk. To offer one to his visitor never crossed his mind. He was far too intent on the contents of the letter. Popping the mint into his mouth, he transferred it with his tongue to his left cheek. That way he could talk while letting it dissolve slowly. "Tibetan," he remarked. Well, that is most interesting, really most interesting. Only last year one was hoping to visit your country, but, unfortunately, it wasn't possible. It is a most difficult country to visit, as you will know, of course. But I have a special interest in flying machines." He had resumed his seat and leaned forward as he spoke with an air of excitement. "Now, tell me, is it true that you use man-lifting kites in your country? I am extremely anxious to know more about this rumor." At this point of his career, Charles was putting much of his own scholarship into words, writing so that others might benefit from his hard, unremitting work. He had already had one book published, a beautifully produced tome written for the elite, for the few who could appreciate him and his studies. After the success of the first book, he was working on a second. It was to be about flying machines and he had done extensive research. He had traveled and interviewed and observed. He had visited libraries and spent hours poring over books and manuscripts, working long into the night sometimes. He enjoyed writing. He enjoyed seeing his work in print and hearing from others of like mind. He felt he belonged to a small group of sensitive, learned people. It was a passion with him, and to actually be confronted by a man from Tibet who might be able to tell him about these so-called man-lifting kites was an extraordinary stroke of luck. Man-lifting kites? Most certainly we used them. In fact, kite flying was one of the more enjoyable activities in the lamasery. It wasn't something that all lamas indulged in every day of the week, naturally, but I happened to be fortunate enough to become quite skilled in the art. Dr. Kuhn was pleased with the question, with the way the conversation was going. He had loved kite flying in his youth and had excelled at it. Really, do go on, this is really fascinating, quite fascinating. Well, I can scarcely believe it. So you actually were a lama in your country, is that really so? How fascinating, amazing that you should just walk into my office, what a stroke of luck. Charles was agog. John, as usual, had known the right thing to do, had scored a bull's eye in introducing the two men, and, to tell the truth, my only claim to have had a hand in it at all was that without my prodding he would not have lifted a finger, or a pen in this case, to help Dr. Kuen. John was like that. He always came up with the right thing with no apparent trouble, and rather annoyingly garnered much credit for his cleverness. People in the West find it hard to believe in man lifting kites, Dr. Kuen continued. They find it hard to believe in anything to do with my early life, in fact, so I don't talk about it very much. Yes, I was indeed a lama. At the age of 7 I entered the Chakpari Lamasery, the school of medicine in Lhasa, after sitting outside for 3 days and 3 nights, motionless. Tibet is a hard country, you know, and lamastic life can be extremely hard, so if a boy fails to pass his initial test he is sent home, and much grief and trouble is avoided. It was a fact that he seldom talked about his early life. It was beyond the comprehension of the English people he had met. They seemed to suffer from a racial complacency and distrust of what they saw as foreign, almost as if it were unclean and certainly unsavory. In Charles, however, he recognized an open and interested mind. "And you did the kite flying at the Chakpari Lamasery, then?" asked Charles. "Kite flying, of course, yes, but not the man-lifting type," Dr. Kuen replied. "There was a lamasery a few days' journey by pony from Lhasa. It was called Triyerpa. It perched, or rather clung, to the side of a mountain. It was curious country there. Immense peaks jutted out, rising ever upwards, and great tablelands stretched out from the base of the peaks like terraces. The tablelands were used for man-lifting kite launching because the wind would come up through crevices from ravines far below with such force that a kite could be taken straight up. We made the kites ourselves, of course, from spruce wood poles lashed into a box form with wings. The spruce wood came from India, no such wood would grow in Tibet. The kite would be about 10 by 8 feet and was covered with silk. We made the skids from bamboo. As I said, the wind comes up from the ravines many, many feet below, gushing and roaring with huge force. We relied a lot on ponies in Tibet, you know, sure-footed little animals, and they were hitched to a rope attached to the kite and urged forward at a gallop. When you hit the air current you go straight up. You can see for miles and miles." He paused. It had been another world, another existence altogether. He was glad this man found it interesting. It was a common bond between them, something they shared. Charles was indeed intensely interested. He felt he could listen to his visitor for hours, but it would have to wait for another day. He had an appointment with his literary agent that afternoon that he could not afford to miss. Pulling a gold hunter pocket watch from his waistcoat pocket, he consulted it, and as he did so he was struck with a thought. "My word," he exclaimed, "why don't you write a book?" "That's it, a book about your life." He snapped the watch shut and returned it to his pocket, the while fixing Dr. Kuen with a stare that was challenging in its intensity, and would have intimidated a lesser man. A book about my life. No, no, that's the last thing I would think of doing. Who would read it?" It was a genuine reaction. Dr. Kuen was astonished. In his eyes the Western world was spiritually barren, arid, there would be no interest in or understanding of his life and belief. All that mattered in the West, it seemed to him, was money, power, position, material things. The true art of living had been lost, Westerners had turned their backs on things of the spirit. It was sad but, at the same time, he really had no interest in teaching people to be more spiritually aware. That was not what he was in the Western world for. He was interested only in completing the task he had undertaken, the task to make medical men understand that disease is apparent in the aura long before it manifests in the physical body, and that by using sound, for instance, the colors of the aura can be corrected, the vibrations can be normalized and the illness avoided. But the medical community did not even accept the existence of the aura. It was not going to be easy. Groundwork was perhaps all he would be able to do, groundwork for others to take up in time and use. Medicine had taken the wrong path at the turn of the century when Dr. Kilner was researching the human aura and his work had been shelved in favor of X-rays. It was considered too complicated, and perhaps too metaphysical. Charles regarded his visitor for a moment. He was not accustomed to having his ideas rejected point blank. Normally, in such a situation he would simply shrug, pity the poor fool so bereft of common sense not to recognize his brilliance, and turn his mind to other things. But his mental appetite was sufficiently whetted that he had no intention of allowing this person to escape his grasp just yet. "Well, I understand from John Rouse's note that you need employment, and that means one thing, you need to make a living. Well, I'll tell you quite frankly, you won't find employment among other people. Forgive my saying so, but you don't fit the mold any more than I do. No, you will have to create your own employment. Do you need money to live? Do you need an occupation? What exactly is it that brings you to this country, to the Western world? There must be a story there, never mind the details of your youth." He was forthright, outspoken and almost rude. Many years later, Dr. Kuhn told me that it was at this point that he understood the antipathy I felt, but had not openly expressed, towards Charles. However, he himself was not in the least perturbed. In fact, he preferred this type of exchange to that veiled in superficial good manners. He had learned to be extremely cautious of Westerners, but because he knew this man was, in a sense, his last hope, he was prepared to be reasonably open with him. "A story? Yes, I suppose you could say there's a story. The real point of it is that I have work to do, I have specialized research to do. I happen to be unusually clairvoyant. It isn't easy, you know, to be possessed of extrasensory abilities. In many ways it's a curse. But because I can see the human aura, just for one thing, I have taken on a task. Do you follow me?" he asked, pausing to scrutinize his listener. "Yes, I believe you do. As we speak, I can see your aura. I would see it even more clearly if you were unclothed, because the clothes you are wearing have their own emanations which somewhat obscure your personal colors, colors which are swirling around you all the time." He paused again. He knew this was not an everyday subject to his listener, and he had no wish to rush or confuse him. "You ask, do I need money to live? My needs are simple as are those of my wife, but, of course, we have to eat and we need shelter. So, to answer your question, I need very little money to live, although I confess I don't enjoy hunger. I need money for my work. I need a lot of money for my work. I am not averse to asking for it because what I am doing will benefit mankind. But people, you know, seldom give freely, they give with strings attached, and I am not interested in that kind of giving. You are correct in saying that I need to work alone, but a book, well, I don't know. Have it your own way, then." Charles was suddenly curt, impatient. "I will tell you frankly, though, there is no other way I can assist you. As it happens, I have an appointment with my literary agent at 4 o'clock this afternoon. It is now 3:25. I am inviting you to accompany me. I believe he could be of help. He could put you on the right track, tell you if my idea is feasible or not." He raised himself heavily from his chair, took another mint and crossed to an ornate cupboard standing behind Dr. Kuhn. Opening the door, he took out an old Burberry Macintosh and laid it across his arm. "Cecil Banks is his name, an excellent contact. What about it?" Dr. Kuhn rose. His face was impassive. It was impossible to know if he was pleased or offended, but with an old-world courtesy, in sharp contrast to the manner of the other, he inclined his head and joined his hands in a gesture of agreement, but with no trace of subservience. "I shall be happy to accompany you," he said. The two men walked back along the corridors to the main entrance, the people they met standing aside to let them pass. Charles seemed not to notice, accepting it as his right. As they passed through the heavy revolving door, the afternoon was still grey and overcast, cheerless. They walked down the wide steps together, pigeons scattering at their coming. Charles hailed a taxi, giving an address in Regent Street, and they sat back in silence, each with his own thoughts. As they rounded Hyde Park Corner, Charles tapped Dr. Kuhn on the knee. I do hope you will consider this idea, but even if you decide against it for some reason, which I can't help saying would be most short-sighted even so, I would still like you to come to see me again. You have such valuable information, I can't afford to lose it. When Dr. Guan was recounting this day to me some years afterwards, he told me how amused he had felt at such blatant poor manners and price setting. Nevertheless, his appreciation of Charles was sincere and he was repaid in full for his effort. Banks and Company, literary agent's office was situated on an upper floor of a building in Regent Street. Alighting from the taxi, they wended their way through the unending throng of people hurrying along the pavement, a mass of humanity all going somewhere, seemingly without a second to lose, heads down, intent. There were surprisingly few loitering looking at shop windows, but there were those as well to be avoided before they entered a sort of arcade with a door in the middle through which they passed. Here it was quiet and dark, their feet echoed on the stone floor as they followed a sign saying lift. Charles pressed the call button with familiarity and they watched as the ancient cage lift descended from the upper floors, wheezing and creaking as it made its slow appearance. Hardly had it made its final bump of arrival than the metal gate was clanked open by the attendant, maybe even the original attendant at that, so dilapidated and aged he seemed. "Afternoon, Governor," he greeted Charles, whom he obviously knew, and just the merest nod of his head to Dr. Kewen, his withering look saying louder than words, "Bleeding yellow foreigner with his beard and shaved head. Pity he don't go back where he come from." He put the lift in motion and they made a labored ascent to the third floor, the attendant whistling softly between his teeth. "Right, here we are," he announced, sliding back the gate, "get yours on the way down, then." They stepped out onto a red carpeted floor, and had only gone a few yards before reaching a rather imposing door with a discreet brass plate to one side, more like a specialist's consulting rooms than a business undertaking, and leading one to the conclusion that Cecil Banks preferred to be thought of as a professional. Charles entered without knocking and Dr. Guan followed. It was a modest and not particularly orderly looking office, one could say almost in need of a good clean, but it was comfortable and not in the least intimidating. A woman of indeterminate age was sitting behind a straight-lined desk and she rose as they entered, coming forward to greet them in a friendly but respectful way. "Good afternoon, sir, I'll let Mr. Banks know you're here." Charles parked himself in one of the chairs, indicating that Dr. Guan should take the other. "Yes, well thank you, Miss Bartle. Perhaps you could tell him that I've brought along a budding writer for him." Dr. Guan felt extremely uncomfortable. He did not see himself as a budding writer to begin with. But he also dreaded interviews or meetings with more than one stranger at a time because he was almost totally deaf and had to rely on lip reading and thought patterns for conversation. It was difficult with two people unknown to him. I had asked why he kept his deafness so hidden, and his response was that to the average person, to be deaf was to be daft, and one was treated accordingly if known to be deaf. As it turned out, he was able to manage quite well in the ensuing interview. He found Cecil Banks amiable, jovial almost. As they were shown into his office by Miss Bartle, he rose with enthusiasm, extending his hand warmly. An elderly man sporting a goatee beard, he appeared sophisticated in a nonchalant way, with a yellow silk tie and an impeccably cut suit. Brown suede shoes rounded off the impression of literary, artistic, legal and business acumen all combined in one, and all being necessary for his work. "My dear fellow, delighted to see you," he exclaimed, as he clasped Charles by the hand. "And I have to tell you, the book is doing well, still selling, a remarkable achievement for any work with a limited, elite audience. And your companion?" He turned to Dr. Guan, "a budding writer, I understand. Always interested, don't you know, always interested in new talent. Do sit down, won't you? Cigar?" He offered a box of Havana cigars, both his visitors declining, but he took one himself and proceeded to cut it. Leaning back in his chair, he surveyed his client and prospective new client. Charles was introducing Dr. Guan in, for him, a remarkably enthusiastic manner. "Guan? ruminated Banks, searching his mind. Chinese maybe? Ah, Tibetan, well how interesting. And your doctorate? Philosophy, perhaps? No? Ah, medicine from Chongqing. I see, I see. He was skilled in gleaning information, in summing up and assessing, but in spite of his experience and astuteness he was having difficulty placing Dr. Kuan in any of his categories. Charles interrupted, "You have to understand that our friend here is a medical lama trained in Tibet and China. In addition, he has most unusual powers. Now that may be not uncommon there, but here." He turned for a moment addressing Dr. Kuan, "If you will forgive my saying so, well, here you are most exceptionally uncommon, I believe. Now, Banks, looking back to the agent, you know that I am not a stupid man, I am in fact, without wishing to appear conceited, quite above average in intelligence." Cecil nodded gravely, puffing out a cloud of cigar smoke. Yes, he would agree with that. Even if it had not been true, he would have agreed. Charles was, after all, his client. His book was doing well, and he was promising another. Kuan is at a loose end just now, isn't that right? Charles went on, looking at Dr. Kuan for confirmation. Yes, well, so I have hit upon the most exciting idea that he should, no, that he must, write a book about his life in Tibet. He sat back, puffed with self-importance and pride in disclosing his brainwave. I would certainly concur with your idea, said Cecil. A most excellent idea. Yes, well, of course we will have to have a synopsis first, just to give me an idea of your life, Dr. Kuan, and who we should approach for publication, all that sort of thing. As he talked his mind raced ahead. He had been in the business a long time, he knew writers, he knew publishers. Too old for active service in the war he had stayed behind in London, sending his wife to the country to their married daughter, and had done his bit firefighting and helping out where he could with the devastation. Unlike many younger men, he had been able to keep his business afloat, albeit it in a minimal way. It had given him a head start over the rest. To his certain knowledge, nothing had been published in the English language about the life of a lama in a lamasery in Tibet actually written first-hand. There were, of course, people who had been to Tibet, scholars, explorers and similar, people who professed familiarity with the country and had written about it, but it was still veiled in mystery because of the impossibility of penetrating the inner life of the lamaseries. He could hardly believe that facing him calmly, sitting in his office on this grey, nondescript London afternoon, was a lama from that culture. Would he be capable of writing? But if not, well, never mind, they could always get someone to ghost it. In any event, he must, he felt, encourage the idea. Already he was forming a picture of a bestseller in his mind. I'm so glad you came to see me, he said, addressing Dr. Kuan directly. As a medical man, you may have little or no writing experience, but that doesn't matter in the least. Your life appears to be so fascinating. We can always get help with writing if necessary. I would like you, as I say, to let me have a synopsis, a brief overview, of what you have in mind. We can take it from there. I am definitely interested. I would be pleased to act for you. He waited as the other weighed up his words. Despite his being supposedly at a loose end, as Charles had put it, he did not appear too enthused at the prospect of writing. Banks could see he was not going to get an immediate agreement. Perhaps making his private life public was going to be difficult, not everyone wanted to do that. After a pause, Dr. Kuan stood up. He felt this was his cue to leave. He knew the other two had business to talk. Besides, he himself was exhausted. Sitting on chairs was uncomfortable for any length of time. At home he either sat cross-legged or reclined on his bed, and he had found the afternoon taxing both physically and mentally. Thank you, Mr. Banks, I will certainly consider the matter, he said. But, you know, with a slight, almost mischievous smile, I believe I can write at least as well as any ghostwriter you might suggest. The secret of writing, as you will know, is an understanding of human nature. I am thoroughly acquainted with that. He bowed politely, and turning to Charles said, believe me, I am most grateful to you. If I can be of any assistance regarding kites or flying antiquated planes, as I did in the China-Japanese War, Mr. Rouse knows how to get in touch with me. He shook hands, and turned to leave. Banks rang for Miss Bartle to show him out. Once again back down in the street he found the dusk calming. It deadened the eternal din somehow, and obscured the hundreds of hurrying faces, making them depersonalized in a welcoming way. Should he take a bus, he wondered, or could he manage to walk, saving the bus fare and giving himself time to think? He could stop at Lion's Corner House at Marble Arch and get something to eat, perhaps a frozen steak and kidney pie they could put in the oven when he got back to the rooming house where he and his wife lived. He wondered what sort of mood Rab, his wife, would be in. A manic depressive, one never knew, she could be up or she could be down. Heaven knows, she had enough to make her down. It was a strange relationship, platonic, not always harmonious, but she depended on him, and it was a commitment he had made to take care of her. What was she going to say to him writing a book, tapping away at a typewriter hour after hour? If he did this book, and he might be forced to, it might be the only way to get money for his work into the human aura, he would have to get a typewriter, ribbons, paper. A pawn shop, maybe. He liked pawn shops. He would often look in the windows, there were things you would never see anywhere else. Yes, a pawn shop would be a good place to find a typewriter, but it would all cost money and money was a commodity he did not possess. He had started a small business a couple of years ago. It was not doing badly when Rab took it into her head that it was the wrong thing for them, and had withdrawn most of their savings, burned the banknotes, and he came home to find the chimney on fire. That was when they were living outside London. That was the end of it and the start of no money, or precious little. Well, at least he could type, although he only had the use of a finger and thumb on each hand, thanks to the Japanese and their tortures. They had captured him when he was flying medical mercy planes during the war with China. They had been sure he could give them information. His spine had been damaged too. That was another problem he would have to face, sitting for long periods of time. He would have to have the typewriter on his lap, they had no table and, besides, he could not manage to sit on a chair for long. He would sit on the floor, it was firmer than the squeaking bed. He would put his pillow behind his back. He could get the synopsis done within a matter of days. Already, though, he could feel warnings. Already he knew it could bring fame and adulation, notoriety and disbelief. He wanted neither. He wanted to be left alone to do his job. Before he made a decision, he would have to consult with others in the astral. It was a good walk back to Queensway and his back was painful, but he was used to pain. Hunger was worse. He had the pie in a paper bag, and the immediacy of his hunger spurred him on. If Rab had not been at home, perhaps also hungry, he would have stopped somewhere to eat it, even in its frozen state. At least, they always saw that QI, their Siamese cat, had food. He loved the little creature, and had an understanding with her. As he turned the key and opened the door of the tall Victorian row house, he heard the landlady screaming at one of the other tenants about toilet paper again. She was obsessed with the idea that they were all stealing it, although what they were supposed to be doing with it was not ever clear. He climbed the stairs, dark brown and dingy, managing to avoid her by stepping into the bathroom on the half landing until she had disappeared, grumbling and cursing tenants under her breath. But there was no avoiding the smell of food, cabbage, boiled mutton, kippers, a conglomeration of cheap food that individually smelled awful but collectively repulsive. He kept his thoughts firmly focused on the steak and kidney pie, the pastry crisp on the top, thick and soggy with delicious gravy on the bottom of the plate. For the moment he needed food. Tonight he would journey far, far away, out of the body, in an altered state altogether, and would get the answers and assurances he needed. For now he had to look after the dense physical body he inhabited, the vehicle he needed to do the work that had to be done. Back in Regent Street, in the comfortable office high above the crowds, Charles and Cecil Banks remained silent for a few moments, neither knowing quite what to say and both conscious of the presence of the man who had just left. "Well now, what do you say to a drink? I have an excellent scotch, you really should try it." Cecil recovered his composure first and got up to fetch glasses and whiskey. "Splendid, what a good idea.